Welcome to the Republican Professor. I'm your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. It's Tuesday, 14 October 2025, years after Jesus. It's Charlie Kirk's birthday today, and I wanted to get into the backstory of TRP, back to high school for me. I'm going to share a book that I was reading in high school about the college campuses, about how crazy they were. I was aware of it in high school, and I was deeply disturbed about what I was reading about back in the 90s. The book is by Dinesh D'Souza called Illiberal Education. And, well, fast forward, here we are, and higher education has become a Democrat indoctrination, grade inflation plantation at taxpayer expense. As I said back in March of 2018, I said that, and I believed it a long time ago, even as Dinesh was relatively unknown at the time. Here's a picture of the book. This is not the copy that I had, but this is the printing of the book that I had. I don't know where my copy went. I think I had left it at my mom's house, at my parents' house, and then when my dad died and they lost the house, somehow the book got lost. But I'm pretty sentimental about stuff like that, but I picked up another copy, and I'm not sure where I got this. Maybe Stevens Books in La Mirada before they closed down. But this book was something that... it's hard to describe the power that this book had on my high school mind. It was revolting, what I was reading. It was deeply disturbing to me. I wrote an article about it in the high school newspaper, the Chatfield Charter, where I went to high school, Chatfield High School in Jefferson County, little town called Littleton, Colorado. This is in 1991 that this was published. And you can see the trajectory of the problems from reading this book, which is why I'm bringing it up. Because the problems did not get solved. They got worse. They got a lot worse. And I went right into the fire. And I did the best I could. But the problems got a lot worse. A lot of the reason for the problems is that Republican parents send their kids to get their Democrat diplomas, and they're so proud of their kids getting those Democrat diplomas. And they fund the satanic madness when they don't have to. They fund it with tax money when they don't have to. They never did have to. Now, are we going to do Psalms today and Streams and Desert? Yes. I have a feeling that people don't like it at the beginning. And people are so lazy that they don't realize they can fast forward, or maybe they just don't care. It's probably one or both. It's probably both. I have such a low view of human nature. It could be any number of things. I think we need to put our nose into this. That's me. I might be by myself. But we're going to do Streams in the Desert in the middle today. And I'm going to start in on this book. Dinesh published this 1991, Free Press, Division of Macmillan. It's in New York. It's for Laura Ingraham. That's what it says. And its subtitle is The Politics of Race and Sex on Campus, Illiberal Education. You want to see a picture of Dinesh back then? Look at that young whippersnapper. I was reading this when I was 16, 17 years old, as soon as it came out. I got a copy at Summit Ministries in Manitou Springs. I'm almost certain that's where I got my copy. Probably in the summer of 1991 is my guess. Might have been summer 1992, possible. No, it had to be 1991 because I wrote the article probably my junior year. I have a copy of the school newspaper. In the acknowledgments, Dinesh says the information in this book was assembled from a wide array of first-hand sources. He had research assistants, numerous university officials, faculty, students, background information, press clippings, internal documents, interviews. Let me throw out a few names that he thanks here. That I have a connection that ring a bell for me. Harmeet Dhillon, Mary Eberstadt, Ken Masugi, Christopher DeMuth. Wow. He mentions Jeffrey Hart. His college, this is what he says. I owe more than I can express to my college teachers, especially Jeffrey Hart. And that's of Dartmouth. And Harry Jaffa of Claremont McKenna College. Dinesh, what was the link with Harry Jaffa? I'm very interested. Harry Jaffa is my political philosophy grandfather and constitutional law grandfather. He trained my mentors, for example, Michael Uhlman, who was my mentor for over 10 years. Chapter one's called The Victim's Revolution on Campus, page one. We're going to do a fair use, make a transformative reading of this material. We'd like to thank Dinesh D'Souza for writing it and the Free Press for making it available. Please go out and get your copy. Get your copy. Make sure you get a copy of this. There are few places as serene and opulent as an American university campus. The students move in small groups, headed for the class, library, or the dining hall, greeting their friends and apparently conscious of being part of a community. At the major universities, gigantic auditoriums, dormitories, and gymnasiums sprawl across the landscape, advertising a tremendous investment of resources. At the prestige schools, such as those of the Ivy League, impressive domes and arches give off a distinct aroma of old money and tradition. Across the lawns, the scholars come and go, talking of Proust and Michelangelo, tributes to the largesse of democratic capitalism. American universities are nevertheless intellectual and social enclaves. By design, somewhat aloof from the pressures of the real world. For the last decade or so, that would be 1980 on, the larger society has not heard much from the university, certainly little of the truculence and disruption that seemed a campus staple in the late 60s and early 70s. Certainly little. The reason for the taciturn university atmosphere of the 80s, commentators generally agree, is that the current generation of young people lacks social consciousness. and cares mainly about careers and making money. Yet, in the past few years, the American campus appears to be stirring again. University outsiders have been shocked to hear of the proliferation of bigotry on campus. At the University of Michigan, for example, someone put up posters which said, "A mind is a terrible thing to waste, especially on a nigger." That's the direct quote from that poster. I'm reading exactly the words as they're written, okay? So I'm not going to switch it to N-word or whatever, because why would I assume you know what N-word I'm talking about if you look in the dictionary under N? There's lots of words. You might think I mean neighbor as if I'm Mr. Rogers or something. I've enjoyed playing around with that because of I think it's an interesting co commentary on race, and how easily we are bullied into thinking we're bad people for no good reason, and in fact, in direct conflict with good reason. I shared a story many years ago. I said, I called my, I was sharing this story. I said, I called my, my neighbor the, the N-word. And I said, "What up, N-word?" And, there was a gasp. Well, later I clarified that the N-word I had in mind was neighbor. And then I asked, "What N-word did you think I had in mind?" And of course, they didn't say. They said, "Well, the N-word." And I said, "Well, which one?" Now, they had an N-word in their mind that came to their mind. I didn't put it in their mind, it came to their mind on their own. It was a very interesting exercise. Back to Dinesh D'Souza. Typically, these ugly incidents are accompanied by noisy protests and seizures of administration buildings by minority activists who denounce the university as institutionally racist. Remember, this is in 1991. He's writing it in 1990. It was published in 1991. Give you a sense of how long these problems have been festering and that they've gotten worse. When a problem gets worse, you want to study the problem and you want to get to it and face it directly. I studied this when I was in high school. I was reading this in high school. I wrote about it immediately. I was so disturbed about it. I was trying to get other people to be bothered by it too. Some success, but not as much as I'd hoped. It really focused my the way I was looking at what I would do with my life to solve problems. Both bewildered and horrified, the university leadership adopts a series of measures to detoxify the atmosphere, ranging from pledges to reform the quote my white male curriculum unquote to censorship of offensive speech. Both university insiders as well as informed off-campus observers, we're done with page one, page two at the top, know that the recent incidents of bigotry have produced a good deal of excess on all sides. Responding to several cases of insensitivity, or flagrant bigotry at Michigan, student and faculty activists demanded that all black professors, and again, I don't use these terms. He's using the term, okay? I'm just reading it. I would say so-called black, be given immediate tenure, that admissions requirements such as standardized test scores be abolished. There's grade inflation right there. But these are Democrats. Dinesh is too nice. He's doing a wonderful job of the political phenomenology, but he doesn't say they're Democrats. In his 2016 film, Hillary, he finally uses the Democrat word. Good job. You have to lay it out. Higher education had become a Democrat indoctrination, grade inflation plantation at taxpayer expense. Higher education had become a Democrat indoctrination, grade inflation plantation at taxpayer expense. How many times do I have to say it? Grade inflation. The Democrats want grade inflation. Pay attention to that. What can you infer from that? There's something about the spirit behind the Democratic Party that requires grade inflation. Grade inflation ensures a lack of discipline and stupidity, willful ignorance at solving real problems. And that female and minority students be permitted to conduct hearings to penalize white students, I would say so-called white students, whom they find guilty of making racially and sexually stigmatizing remarks. These came to pass in the Obama administration when the Obama Assistant Secretary of Education for Civil Rights, wrote a letter of guidance, threatening federally funded institutions if there weren't these kangaroo courts that dismissed due process for selected races and sexes on campus. It's not just freedom of religion that was targeted, or freedom of speech, freedom of association, like the Democrats targeted during segregation, the right to keep and bear arms, which the Democrats targeted during segregation and slavery, of course. They don't like the Constitution. I don't know if you can see this. In this case, the university administration took each of these demands seriously. Remember, this is 1990. And partially acquiesced in them, agreeing to give preferential treatment to minority student and faculty applicants over non-minorities with stronger qualifications, and to adopt censorship regulations outlawing speech offensive to, quote, persons of color, and he has the quotations around them. Good job. Good job, Dinesh. As well as women. And shoot, you could put quotations around that now, because look where that led. And homosexuals. Look where that led. It's not always obvious in these disputes whose side a reasonable person should take, or whether it is possible, in good conscience, to endorse any side at all. The middle ground seems to have disappeared as a consequence of ideological fracas and polarization. Whether it can be restored is an open question. You wonder about the polarization in our political life here? It's directly related to this. Maybe it was even caused by this. Why do we allow it to fester so long? Why didn't we fix this immediately? I know that Rush Limbaugh was doing his job and, you know, Dinesh D'Souza was doing his job, but why did it take so long to address this effectively? But for those who visit any American campus, D'Souza continues on page 2 in the middle, peruse the student newspaper. You better take your glycerin tablets first. Enter the student union and talk with some of the undergraduates, or examine, now they all have their faces in their phones, or examine the lectures and the workshops listed on the bulletin board. It is clear that the heavy publicized racial confrontations on campus are mere symptoms of much deeper changes that are rapidly underway with far-reaching consequences for American society. These are changes in the intellectual and moral infrastructure of the American university, not in its outer trappings. Within the tall gates and old buildings, a new worldview is consolidating itself. Remember, this is 1990. The transformation of American campuses is so sweeping that it is no exaggeration to call it an academic revolution. Should put the quotations around academic, you can call it that. The distinctive insignia of this revolution can be witnessed on any major campus in America today and in all major aspects of university life. Remember, this is 1990. What could possibly go wrong? I was reading this in high school. I wrote about this in my high school newspaper when I was, I think, a junior. It might have been when I was a sophomore. I think it was when I was a junior. We're going to get into some specific examples that D'Souza mentions, but let's get to our psalm. Reading from Psalm 42 and 43. Let's do Psalm 42 and 43. I think they're meant to be read together. This is the King James Version. As the hart panteth after the water brooks, so panteth my soul after thee, O God. My soul thirsteth for God, the living God. When shall I come and appear before God? My tears have been my meat day and night, while they continually say unto me, Where is thy God? When I remember these things, I pour out my soul in me, for I had gone with the multitude. I went with them to the house of God, with the voice of joy and praise, with a multitude that kept holy day. Why art thou cast down, O my soul? And why art thou disquieted in me? Hope thou in God, for I shall yet praise him for the help of his countenance. O my God, my soul is cast down within me. Therefore will I remember thee from the land of Jordan and from the Hermonites, from the hill of Mizar. Deep calleth unto deep at the noise of thy waterspouts. All thy waves and thy billows are gone over me. Verse 8 Psalm 42. Yet the Lord will command his loving kindness in the daytime, and in the night his song shall be with me, and my prayer unto the God of my life. I will say unto God my rock, Why hast thou forgotten me? Why go I mourning because of the oppression of the enemy? As with the sword in my bones, mine enemies reproach me, while they say daily unto me, Where is thy God? Verse 11, Psalm 42. Why art thou cast down, O my soul, and why art thou disquieted within me? Hope thou in God, for I shall yet praise him, who is the health of my countenance and my God. Psalm 43. Judge me, O God, and plead my cause against an ungodly nation. O deliver me from the deceitful and unjust man. For thou art the God of my strength. Why dost thou cast me off? Why go I mourning because of the oppression of the enemy? O send out thy light and thy truth. Let them lead me. Let them bring me unto thy holy hill and to thy tabernacles. Verse 4, Psalm 43. We got two more verses left. Then will I go unto the altar of God, unto God my exceeding joy. Yea! Upon the harp will I praise thee, O God of my God. Why art thou cast down, O my soul? Why thou art disquieted within me? Hope in God, for I shall yet praise him, who is the health of my countenance and my God. Psalm 42 and 43, a moment of reflection. Streams in the Desert, January 12th, Kalman Publications, Los Feliz Station, Los Angeles, California, 1925, page 13. Reckon it nothing but joy whenever you find yourself hedged in by various trials. Be assured that the testing of your faith leads to power of endurance. That's James 1, verses 2 and 3. God hedges in his own that he may preserve them, but oftentimes they only see the wrong side of the hedge and so misunderstand his dealings. It was so with Job 3:23. Ah, but Satan knew the value of that hedge. See his testimony in chapter 1, verse 10. Through the leaves of every trial, there are chinks of light to shine through. Thorns do not prick you unless you lean against them. And not one touches without his knowledge. The words that hurt you, the letter which gave you pain, the cruel wound of your dearest friend, shortness of money, are all known to him, who sympathizes as none else can and watches to see if, through all, you will dare trust him wholly. Wholly, W-H-O-L-L-Y. The hawthorn hedge that keeps us from intruding looks very fierce and bare. When stripped by winter, every branch protruding its thorns that would wound and tear. But springtime comes, and like the rod that budded, each twig breaks out in green, and cushions soft of tender leaves are studded where spines alone were seen. The sorrows that to us seem so perplexing, our mercies kindly sent to guard our wayward souls from sadder vexing and greater ills prevent. To save us from the pit, no screen of roses would serve for our defense. The hindrance that completely interposes stings back like thorny fence. Page 14 at the top. At first, when smarting from the shock, complaining of wounds that freely bleed, God's hedges of severity us paining may seem severe indeed. But afterwards, God's blessed springtime cometh, and bitter murmurs cease. The sharp severity that pierced us bloometh, and yields the fruits of peace. Then let us sing our guarded way, thus wending life's hidden snares among, of mercy and of judgment sweetly blending, earth's sad but lovely song. January 12th, Streams in the Desert, a moment of reflection. All right, let's get back to work. This is a thick book, and it's a little bit intimidating to think that I could do it justice with any kind of commentary or anything like that, but I'm just going to let D'Souza shine here. Admissions policy. Let's just start there, page 2 at the bottom. Virtually all American universities have changed their admissions rules so that they now fill a sizable portion of their freshman class each year with students from certified minority groups. Certified? Ooh, sounds official. Mainly blacks and Hispanics. Again, I would say so-called blacks, who have considerable lower grade point averages and standardized test scores than so-called white, I'm putting that in, he has just white, and Asian American applicants who are refused admission. Since it is often difficult for minorities admitted on the basis of preferential treatment to compete, most universities offer an array of programs and incentives, including cash grants, to encourage these students to pass their courses and stay in school. Page 3 at the top. The coveted perks of so-called affirmative action policies have sometimes been extended to other groups claiming deprivation and discrimination, such as American Indians. Nice job, D'Souza. Good job. Natives of third world countries. Women. Vietnam veterans, the physically disabled, now sometimes called differently abled, homosexuals, and lesbians. I'm not sure why he puts lesbians as a separate but equal category than homosexuals. It seems like lesbians would be a part of homosexuals. At the University of California at Berkeley, Black and Hispanic student applicants are up to 20 times or 2,000% more likely to be accepted for admission than Asian American applicants who have the same academic qualifications. Ernest Konigsberg, a Berkeley professor of business who has served on several admission committees, asks us to imagine on a student applicant Imagine student applicant with a high school grade point average of 3.5 out of 4 and a scholastic aptitude test SAT score of 1,200 out of 1,600. For a black student, Konigsberg says, the probability of admission to Berkeley is 100%. But if the same student is Asian American, I really hate these categories. And David Bernstein does a wonderful job in a recent book. We really need to cover that on the podcast, where he does a deep dive on these descriptions, like, for example, Asian American. You know that the continent of Asia is huge, right? You know it's the largest continent. You know that, right? Okay. It extends from Lebanon to how far? How far? You know, Vietnam? Siberia? Is Japan part of Asia? It's not a part of the continent. Did I say something wrong? What's Asian mean? Anyway, I want to be too clunky here, but I'm just putting that in there. If the same student is Asian American, he calculates, the probability of admission is less than 5%. Konigsberg, one of the architects of the policy, is satisfied with this outcome. Quote, I suppose it's unjust in a way, but all rules are unjust, unquote. These are bullet points. He's got a series of bullet points, and the bullet points I'm just reading because they're just fantastic. At Ivy League colleges, which are among the most competitive in the nation, incoming freshmen have average grade scores close to 4.0 and average SATs of 1250 to 1300. According to admission officials, however, several of these schools admit Black, Hispanic, and American Indian students with grade averages as low. Oh, I'm so excited. I just found a typo. Why am I excited? Because I never find typos in good books anymore, seems like. And I don't know, I don't want to use a pen, but I just found a typo. Should be as low as. Two point five and SAT aggregates in the 700 to 800 range. Man, a similar pattern can be found at state schools. Over the past 5 years, the University of Virginia has virtually doubled its Black enrollment by accepting more than 50% of Blacks who apply and fewer than 25% of whites, even though white students generally have much better academic credentials. In 1988, for example, the average white freshman at the university scored 240 points higher on the SAT than the average Black freshman. An admissions dean told the Washington Post, "We take in more from the groups with weaker credentials and make it harder for those with stronger credentials," unquote. Jeez. At Pennsylvania State University, I wonder where that is. I guess it's probably in Pennsylvania. Preferential treatment of Black students extends beyond admissions. The university offers financial incentives to induce Blacks to maintain minimum grades and graduate. All Black students who maintain a grade average of C to C plus during the course of the year get checks from the school for $580, page four at the top. For anything better than that, they get $1,160. This official policy endures for all 4 years of college. It is not connected with financial aid. It applies regardless of economic need. White and other minority students are ineligible for the cash awards. Financial subsidies are also offered elsewhere. starting in the fall of 1990 as part of a program to increase black enrollment by 50%, Florida Atlantic University. Don't think I've ever heard of that university. I've heard of Florida Pacific. Florida Atlantic University is offering free tuition to every black student who is admitted, regardless of financial need. President Anthony Catanese, I don't know how to say that, said it, the measure is necessary to demonstrate that FAU is serious about recruiting. Miami-Dade Community College recruits minority students by promising that if they do not find jobs in their fields of study after graduation, the college will refund their tuition money. Jeez. No other students qualify for this money-back guarantee. Earlham College in Indiana has a standing offer restricted to black, Hispanic, and American Indian residents of the state. If they choose to attend, the school will replace their student loans with grants. And the University of Nebraska uses state money to fund special scholarships of $1,500 to $3,995, which Vice Chancellor James Greason maintains are essential to correct a documented underrepresentation of specified minorities in our student population. This language of representation in a student population, notice that language, representation. Since when is a student representing anybody but his or herself? And even then, the student is not representing their self. They just are their self. They're not representing anything. They're presenting themselves to be evaluated based on the work that they do. Hello? Hello? Anybody there? What is this representation crap? It's not Congress. You're just a student. See, these things that get said, they just get flippantly said, and you don't critically evaluate what is going on there. Think. Sometimes university leaders offer justifications for these preferences. Erdman Palmore, a Duke University professor who serves as a chairman of Committee on Black Faculty, maintains that financial inducements are essential for minority students and faculty whose social contributions have been historically undervalued. That's another one of these phrases, historically undervalued. Historically, how far back do you want to go? Historically, these colleges didn't even exist. Hello? Hello? By bidding up the price of blacks, wow, that's a direct quote, says Palmore. Quote, we are hoping to increase their value, unquote. Direct quote from a Democrat. Michael Harris, professor of religious studies, that's definitely a Democrat, at the University of Tennessee, argues for greater preferential treatment for minorities and suspension of academic requirements. Did you hear that? And suspension of academic requirements. Higher education is a Democrat indoctrination, grade inflation plantation. Talking about bidding up the price of blacks, suspending academic requirements. This is the language of slavery. This is the language of grade inflation. It's a plantation. Higher education is a Democrat indoctrination, grade inflation plantation at taxpayer expense. This is 1990. Michael Harris, professor of religious studies at University of Tennessee, argues for greater preferential treatment of minorities and suspension of academic requirements because, quote, when you see the word qualifications used, remember that this is the new code word for whites, unquote. Although they are stipulated as the prime beneficiaries, not all blacks feel honored by preferential treatment awards. When Stephen Carter, a graduate of Stanford, applied to Harvard Law School, he received a letter of rejection. Page 4 at the bottom. Then, a few days later, two Harvard officials telephoned him to apologize for their, quote, error, unquote. One explained, we assumed from your record that you were white, unquote. The other noted that the school had recently obtained, quote, additional information that should have been counted in your favor, unquote, namely, the fact that Carter is black. We got a little bit more today. Page 5 at the top. Carter recalled, and this is a black quote, and by the way, I read Carter's book, one of Carter's books when I was deployed in the Navy. I deployed 7 times. I had a very high op tempo. I'd bring books for downtime. Sometimes we had a lot of hurry up and wait downtime. Naturally, says Carter, I was insulted by this. Stephen Carter, the white male, was not good enough for Harvard Law School. Stephen Carter, the black male, not only was good enough, but rated agonized telephone calls urging him to attend. And Stephen Carter, caller unknown, must have been white. How else would he have achieved what he did in college? In other words, my academic record sounded too good for a black Stanford undergraduate, but not good enough for a white Harvard law student. Because I was black, however, Harvard was quite happy to scrape me from what it apparently considered the bottom of the barrel, unquote. What's that quote from? I'm going to look it up. I don't like endnotes. Guys, don't tolerate endnotes. Use footnotes. Footnote 11. Racial preferences, so what? Wall Street Journal, September 13th, 1989. Carter did attend Harvard and is now a professor at Yale Law School. Yeah, I read his book. I don't think it had been published yet. These are pretty good notes. The problem is they're end notes. I don't like that. I want footnotes. I want to be able to look at what the note says right away. I don't want to have to go back. Maybe I'm just complaining. Got a little bit more. Favorable recruitment and hiring policies are not limited to racial minorities at Columbia University. In 1989, and that's AD, it's not BC, just to clarify, the Columbia Law Review announced a recruitment program offering preferential treatment for homosexuals and lesbians. The journal added 5 extra seats to its editorial board to promote, quote, diversity, unquote, including special consideration for, quote, sexual orientation, unquote. I don't think they had anything for Republicans. They're all Democrats. So you see the link between grade inflation and Democrat indoctrination. And these code words like representation, diversity, and so on and so forth that are replacing the purpose of college, which is to learn you out of your ignorance and bad habits. Instead, they're doubling down on bad habits and creating new bad habits and wasting tax money. The book is Illiberal Education: The Politics of Race and Sex on Campus by Dinesh D'Souza, 1991, Free Press. We thank Dinesh for writing it and for Free Press for publishing it. We're going to do a lot more from this book in the coming episodes. This is a backstory episode of the Republican Professor podcast. I promised you some backstory. This is going back to my high school, where I wrote the article myself. I wrote it myself. There was no AI. There was only RI, that is, real intelligence. Thanks for joining me on the Republican Professor podcast on 14 October 2025 years after Jesus. We'll see you next time. It's a Tuesday.